Let me open up with just one quick word. Pessy had asked about it. So you'll notice the top left corner of the sheets. The very last thing that, in my 2 years in the shul, Meir Zichron Livracha, I had actually, we worked plenty together. He was, as everybody knows, quite an active and dedicated gabbai. The very last thing that he and I spoke about was 12 hours before he died. He came over to me and asked me to sponsor this morning's shir, the Eloi Nishmas's father, whose yahrzeit is this week. And, as we all know, the next morning he passed away. So I thought, it was fitting in his memory to fulfill his last request, at least of me. I'm sure in the few hours between then and when he went to sleep, he probably had made several more requests of several other people. But it was the last thing that he asked of me. So, Bezrat Hashem, in the coming weeks and months, we'll have the opportunity to memorialize Meir himself. But in his final request of me, like I said, that it was fitting to dedicate the shir in his father's memory. So as the learning that we do this morning should be not only Lui Nishmas, our dear friend and Gabbai Yitzchak Meir ben Gershon Zichron Livracha, but of his father as well, whose yahrzeit is this week, Gershon ben Yitzchak Meir. Okay, so as we've been discussing, this year, rather than take overarching themes, or rather than take specific sections of the Megillah, what we've been trying to do is take a look at character profiles, and seeing how specific characters in the Megillah actually develop over the course of the story. Number one was, the first shir was of Haman, where we took a close look at him and suggested that, the closer that you look, the less impressive of a character it seems to be. More or less seems to be guided by his, we call it the vaulting ambition, borrowing Shakespeare's term. It was this intense ambition that he had to get ahead, blinded him to everything else. We looked last week in what I think was less of a definitely less convincing than the Haman lecture, but I still think definitely a plausible read. We took a close look at Mordechai, and we noticed how really what characterizes him, both in terms of the language used, the syntax and language of the Megillah, and as well as the actual content of the story, what characterizes Mordechai more often than not is surprisingly passivity. Moments in which we think he should be passive, or we think he should be active, or active in a certain type of way, he's either passive or active in a less effective way than we might have thought. And what we suggested was, the perception that we always have, that many have in the Megillah, is that Mordechai is there behind the scenes pulling the strings, and Esther is the one who is kind of his patsy, kind of his, is there to be controlled in order to move the story along. What we suggested last week, at least as a possibility, is an alternative reading of how to see Esther, how to see Mordechai as actually a much more passive and much less significant character, somebody whose role, at the very best, we said, was a cabinet secretary. Somebody there to dispense advice when requested and to keep the executive informed, but not to make the decisions. And that executive, of course, was Esther. Esther is the one who, I think, when we take a closer look, we're going to see is actually the much more active partner, the much more active character in the Megillah. She's the one that's constantly doing things of her own volition, constantly thinking on her feet, thinking quickly, and making these moves to move the story along. And basically, I think that the possibility of Mordechai being the dominant character ends in the fourth chapter. We have 10 chapters of a story, 10 prakim. The possibility of Mordechai being the dominant character ends in chapter 4. And as we move through the story, Esther basically takes center stage without a word from Mordechai. So I want to look at today. I think everybody would agree. I'll say it this way. Usually, this is the reading that I've had for many years, and that I've heard from many people as well. We're going to take a look at Perek Dalet closely, and many see Perek Dalet, which is Mordechai and Esther conversing about what the plan should be, about how to deal with this evil decree from Haman. Many read that as being this transitional moment for Esther, where she is originally a very soft and timid character, and in this grand moment, she stands and says, "Lech knoset kol ha'yudim," and now she gives the orders to Mordechai. "V'tatzavei ol Mordechai," she sends her messenger to Mordechai and says, "Lech knoset kol ha'yudim," and then from that point on, Mordechai is taking the orders from her, and rather than the reverse. What I'd like to suggest today, all right, and we're going to throw it out there. I titled the shir a Machiavellian or Moribund Queen. We want to know whether Esther is from the very beginning, somebody who is very active, or if her activity only pipes up at in that transitional moment in Perek Daled. Okay, and I think both are plausible reads. And I think as a third read, which is I think less plausible, but certainly possible, that even in her even in her center stage activity from chapter 5 and on, she's still taking orders. It's just that the Megillah doesn't really go out of its way to tell us. So I think there's three perspectives of Esther, right? We'll say the third one that I just mentioned, we'll say first. First is to see her as essentially following her cousin Mordechai's orders, right? And her foster father Mordechai's orders throughout the entire story. The second, I think, is to see her as originally taking orders and being, essentially a soft and timid and passive character, but eventually developing into a much more active one. And the third, which is what I'd like to put out there today, is the possibility of her being more active already from the start. Okay? And it's going to connect, it's going to be the other side of the coin of last week's suggestion about Mordechai being, if Mordechai is the passive character, then the one driving the story then is Esther. So we're going to have to see if we can come up with that. Okay, Perek Aleph we're not going to address. If we had one more shiur, what we would have done for number 3, we would have done Achashverosh. Because a big, big part, as we're going to see today, a big, big part of who Esther was and how she moved the story along is understanding how people tick. Understanding how people work. And understanding how Achashverosh works, most importantly, what his fears and anxieties are, is probably the most essential part of the story. Because while he is the king, he is the king that is being influenced by, if not controlled by, again, depending on how you read this story, but he's being heavily influenced by other people. It starts with his main advisors in the first chapter, and then we shift into Haman in the second chapter, and then as we move forward, it ends up being Esther that's really that's moving these things along. Not because Achashverosh is, as we've been pointing out, as we pointed out a couple of times, not because I think Achashverosh in the story, even in the story, is an aimless fool, but because he has personal anxieties and fears that he guides his decision making based on them. Knowing those anxieties and fears is how his servants get what they need done. It's the trick that Haman learns, which we spoke about in the Haman shir, and it's the trick that Esther is going to learn as well. Now, because we can't fully develop Achashverosh's character, we're not really going to be able to see this so in such detail inside, but we'll leave it at that. So chapter 1, Perek Aleph, is where we are introduced to Achashverosh, and we are introduced at the very beginning to these fears. Okay, the first thing that I want to, the only thing that I really want to point out other than that in Perek Aleph is the part that I bolded, all right? Same system as last week. I'll explain the colors when we get to them, but the small print is something that is there for our reference if we want it, but not essential to our discussion today. So all of Perek Aleph is in small print. But just look at the very beginning. How does the Megillah open? He is the monarch over this enormous, enormous empire. 127 provinces. By Amimahem, in those days, Keshevet HaMelech HaChashverosh Al Kisim Achoto Asher B'Shoshana Birah, implying, by the way, that he no longer needs to be conquering these 127 provinces. He's now sitting on the throne that he has established for himself in Shushan. All right, and now Pasuk Gimel is what I just want to highlight. At what point in this man's monarchy, in this king's monarchy, are we looking at? Bishnat Shalosh LaMalcho, in the third year of his reign. All right, and then he makes the party. Keep that in mind, because one of the things that's very difficult to keep grasp as we're reading the story is the fact that how time is passing over the course. We read the Megillah in the course of 45 minutes or an hour, depending on your Balkori and the number of groggers that are being spun. But really, this is actually a story that takes place over the course of many, many years. And while we think of Esther in her role as having just been coronated 5 minutes ago, it's actually several years before any of this happens. So let's keep in mind. So point number one, the third year of a reign of an empire that vast is something that we need to keep in mind, because this is somebody at the beginning of his, right, at the beginning of his status as king over this, and emperor over this vast land.
I don't know, in 3 years he amassed 127 million, no?
So what he inherited, the 3 years might be from when he finished amassing. I mean, he only took his seat in Shushan after the empire was complete. And it could be 3 years from now. We don't know. The text doesn't tell us. There's plenty to, depending on who we identify as Achashverosh, and the scholarly literature does this very extensively, and it depends on when we date the Purim story. If it's this guy Xerxes, or if it's the artist, there's different characters that we can date. And there's actually plenty of corroborating historical evidence to this, but I don't want to get into it right now. As far as what I'm concerned with right now, the text is telling us that it's in the 3rd year of his reign. Whether it's the 3rd year of his monarchy or the 3rd year since he, and it took him 2 years to military conquering, and then 1 year, I don't know. The point that I want to make, though, is first of all, that he's an emperor over a vast territory, and secondly, is that he's, relatively speaking, at the beginning of his reign. Okay? Now I want to shift, again, our goal is to discuss Esther today, so I don't want to get too much into this. Perek Aleph, just to repeat as what I said before, the one other theme that I take from Perek Aleph extensively is Achashverosh's concern with his throne. Part of that has to do with, I think, that he's in the early stages of it, but part of it is also that of his particular character and the particular nature of the court, of his own court. Okay. We're going to move to sources. The last thing that I always do when I make these sources is to number them, and I forgot to do that today, so the numbers are all messed up. But you'll stick with me. Okay, we're in Perek Bet, which should be source number 2, on the bottom of page 1. Okay, so we are focusing on Esther, so I don't want to get into all this stuff, but Vashti is deposed. And at the beginning of Perek Bet, Achashverosh wakes up from, not from his drunken stupor, by the way, which usually is how we read this, but it's not. It's what he, Kishoch Chamat HaMelech Achashverosh, when his anger abated. Right? So he was furious at the situation from Perek Aleph, and he calmed down. Not that he sobered up, but that he calmed down. Again, just an important, for all of the readings of Achashverosh as the bumbling drunken fool, that's not what we're talking about here. Okay, so he calms down, and he decides, and immediately his servants come to him and say, okay, we got to replace Vashti. So they come along, and they propose this plan, a plan that was a follow-up of the plan from the previous chapter, where we're going to round up all of the betulot, we're going to round up all of the virgins in the kingdom, and we're going to bring them to you, you're going to have this whole system. Right, we'll get into that in a second, when we're looking at Esther. Okay, so then, after that plan is proposed, we pointed this out last week. Now is when we're introduced to Mordechai. Now, I don't want to get too repetitive of points that we made last week, but we suggested last week, in terms of Mordechai, if he's the dominant character that we're going to be discussing, it's weird that he's only first being mentioned here. The reason being, if he's the dominant character, he should have either be at the beginning of the chapter, or we should be introducing him when there's a story about him to tell, right? Just to repeat this one point last week, because I think it's important. Achashverosh wakes, calms down from his anger. He decides, he comes up with this plan to replace the deposed queen Vashti with bringing all these women into the king's harem. Okay, what's the next part of the story? The next piece of the story, the next bullet point, if you're summarizing the story. Not what the Megillahs read. What's the next thing that happens? Esther is gathered up. So the next piece of the story is Esther's involvement. It's only vis-a-vis Esther's involvement that Mordechai is now introduced. So again, we just pointed this out last week. I think that this is an important textual nuance. We only are introducing Mordechai vis-a-vis Esther, and that, I think, automatically is our first indication that possibly he is not anywhere near as dominant of a character as certain points in the Megillah make him out to be. Okay, so now, introduce Mishu Diyayab Shamira. That's who Mordechai is. Now, we go to Pasuk Zion. Mordechai, we pointed out last week, is third generation since the Galut, and now we have Pasuk Zion. What is Mordechai's actual relevance to this story? Vayihi Omein et Hadassah. He became the foster parent, right? He took in this woman named Hadassah, he Esther, which is a parenthetical statement in Tanakh, who happens to be Esther, the Esther that we're going to be talking about in the coming Psukim. Bat Dodo, Esther was his cousin, the child of his uncle, which is his cousin. Ki ein la aveim. Okay, so now for the color coding for today, the blue is going to be Esther being secondary or being, you know, possibly controlled or maneuvered by Mordechai, Mordechai being the dominant character. Purple is going to be the opposite. It's going to be I think textual indications where Esther is the dominant character and really moving things along, or at the very least we're given indications that's what it's about. I have like a maroonish type of color, which we'll see on the next page, which is where I think we have pieces of text that can go either way, and then the just plain black bold are either important points or generally just important points that we need to make that are contributing to our story. Okay, so we have Vayihiyo Meinat Hadassah, Hi Esther Bat Dodo Ki Ein La Ava. So he takes in this Esther because she doesn't have any parents. And we pointed this out last week. Immediately we're given a character trait of Esther and we are not given any such thing of Mordechai. Right? We're not told Mordechai is brave. We're not told Mordechai is righteous. We're not told Mordechai is smart. We're not even told Mordechai's position in the court, which we're going to see soon. We introduce Mordechai and we introduce Esther. Mordechai's only function is Vayihi Omein et Hadassah Hi Esther Bat Dodo. And we're going to see in a second, or we're going to see the rest of the pasuk that he actually repeats that point. By Esther, though, we're given a character trait. V'hanara yifat toar v'tovat mareh. So she is a beautiful and shapely, it's usually yifat toar, usually how it's translated, right? She was a beautiful woman. And because she was a mature and beautiful woman, that's how to interpret that, I guess. So, because of that, not only are we going to see in a second that this is relevant to the story, but we're already told of something that's important to the character development of Esther. We know nothing about Mordechai other than the fact that he is Esther's foster father. Okay, now if, again, I'll just make this point again, if Mordechai is the mastermind behind everything going on here, then this is the point, if I'm writing a story where I want to give some sort of hint, some sort of indication that Mordechai has some skill or some ability, some know-how that's going to contribute to that skill. All right, that's going to contribute to that development of the story. But it's not what it says. What it says only is that he serves Esther. All right, or what we suggested last week was that he's serving Esther, possibly, but it says that he's the foster father. All right, and you'll see how it's repeated. Vayihi Omein, that's number one. Ki Ein La Ava Eim, it's number two. And then, within the same verse, Uvamot Avi Avi Ima L'Kacha Mordechai L'Levat. All right, so three references within the same pasuk to Mordechai's relationship to Esther. Okay, pasuk Chet. Vayihi B'Yishamad Dvar HaMelech V'Dato U'Vikaveitz Narot Rabot Al Shushana Birel Yad Hegai. So they hear this, what's going on, this royal decree that all the eligible women are, let me make one more point. So the Gemara in Megillah actually points out, has an interesting drasha. It says that Esther, Mordechai took her as his daughter, right? The Gemara in Megillah does something very interesting that isn't really found in any other book in Tanakh. It actually systematically goes through, over the course of several dapim, goes through pasuk by pasuk, the entire Megillat Esther, and gives drashot on it. We have drashot throughout Shas, but it, usually you have to find them and collect them, and in order to have this these midrashim on individual psukim, you have to open up the actual midrashic collections. With Esther, Masechet Megillah actually has sequential drashot on the entire Megillah, which is very interesting. So the drasha in the, I think it's a Yudaf Yud Aleph, the drasha in the Gemara on this point of Lekacha Mordechai Lo Levat is Atikri Levat Ella Labayit. All right, very good. So. Oh, so Larry.
It's not my own.
Okay. Well, it's not Larry's either. It's the.
But would it have been because otherwise it would have been a question of
Yichud? So there are some commentaries that are actually that point that out. So it's possible that that's why that Mordechai married his cousin, his orphaned cousin, whether it's because he loved her or whether it's because they were meant to be together. Part of the problem with this shot, though, is what's the defining characteristic of the women that are gathered into Achashverosh's harem?
They're virgins.
They're betulot. And if they were married, seemingly she was not. Now, I don't know what kind of inspections they were doing or if they just asked you to check off on a box.
Could they have been together?
So if there was Erison as opposed to Nisuin, so I don't want to get into the, this is a Machlokas Rishonim about what the status would be, but I don't want to, it's not irrelevant because it's not a good question or because it's irrelevant in terms of the facts on the ground. What it's irrelevant for is our story. We don't know. So it's a plausible and definitely interesting read, but it's, you know, we just, there's just absolutely no way to get this evidence. The point that I want to make, though, my whole question in these shiurim, though, that we've been discussing is whether or not Esther and Mordechai are dominant or secondary characters. Saying that she's his orphan daughter, his orphan stepdaughter, puts her in a much more of a junior position. Saying that she's his wife, I think, lifts her up into a little bit more of an equal position. And it's a very different, if you think about it, it's a very different story of somebody coming to check on his wife, you know, being Yoshev Beveit HaMelech, Yoshev B'Shar HaMelech, and coming to check on his wife, versus somebody who's coming to check on his orphan stepdaughter. Okay? So that was just one point that I wanted to make. Okay, so they hear the royal decree in Pasuk Chet, and they decide to gather up all of the people, all of these women. Vatilakach Esther al Beit HaMelech, powerless, she is taken to the king. We are given no indication how Esther feels about this. All right, whether she's the Mefarshim are full of little points, little nuances here and there. She was trying to get selected. She was trying to avoid being selected. There's no indication. All it says is this is who Esther was. She lived with Mordechai, and then she was taken into the king's chambers as part of this process. And who did she was she sent to? She was sent Al Yad Hegai Shomer Anashim. Okay, characteristic number two of Esther already in Pasuk Tet. All right. Again, the only thing that we know about Mordechai now is that he's a stepfather or some sort of guardian. Characteristic number two in Pasuk Tet. Vatitav hanara leinav vatisa chesed lefanav. Immediately, well, it's not really a character trait as much as Hegai takes to Esther immediately. Vatitav hanara leinav vatisa chesed lefanav. Some of the Farshim, Latter-day Farshim, point out linguistic parallels or even just story parallels between this and Yosef in Potiphar's house. There's this idea of somebody who's just has a chain to them, and they naturally are attract people, and people like them. The text is actually going to say that about Esther explicitly, but it doesn't tell us why. It doesn't tell us what. All it tells us is that she's taken, and immediately Hegai, who's the quartermaster here, he likes Esther. So, okay, so there's some. We discussed this last year. There's actually some question as to whether Sarice is meant literally or not. In this context, assuming that it is, all right, Sarice being a eunuch, assuming that it is, what's the one thing that, until this point, what's the one thing that we know about Esther? Right? Sorry? She's pretty. Yifat Torah v'tovat mareh. Okay, now, the if she's brought in with a group of people, let's say we're going to amplify what it said about Esther and suggest possibly that not only was she beautiful, but she was the most beautiful of any of these women. Right? What do you think would be the motivation? You know, what do you think would how that would affect her if she's now in a room being guarded or being run by a non-eunuch, right? Somebody who has stands something to gain from the most beautiful woman in the room actually liking her makes sense. I think that there's a hint here immediately that since if we're going to be talking about this Hegai character as being an actual literal Sarice, that immediately it's not just that she's beautiful, but there's something about her that is attractive and special and, you know, kind of magnetic that has nothing to do with her beauty. So, again, this is the type of stuff that if I wanted to write Mordechai as being a dominant character, I would be putting in at the very beginning. Little literary hints that what we're going to be reading about in the subsequent chapters is, you know, reflective of actual character traits. So that means that not only does Hegai like her, but if Hegai is a Sarice, he likes her in a way that seemingly her beauty shouldn't really have anything to do with it. Okay? And Batisachin v'chesed lefanav. Okay, next, we're now in the black bold. V'yivahel et tamrukeh v'yat manoteh latetla, v'yat sheva hanarot haruyot latetla mi'beit ha-melech. So what does Hegai do because he likes her so much? He gives her all of this stuff. He all of the tamurkev manoteh latetla, and then he gives her seven servants in order of from the Beit HaMelech in order to serve her. Now, you know, I think I always read this story as being this is what people got, but it seems to be saying vatisachin v'chesed lefanav mikol absuros that Hegai here is giving her special treatment, and this maybe everybody was getting something, but she was getting special treatment. She's being treated like a queen, right? This is monarchy type of service. Special perfume, special stuff, her own room. Let's finish the pasuk. Where did he? What did he? What else did he do for her? He actually put Esther and all these servants that he gave her in the Beit HaNashim that was Tov. He gave her the best room. He gave her the executive Excelsior suite on the penthouse level. He gave her the best room in the house. This is already, right, kingly, queenly type of treatment that she's getting from Haggai. So not only are we giving a little bit of literary foreshadowing, but we're also given an indication of not only was she likable, not only was she beautiful, but it was to the nth degree. Right? You have to expect that this is a guy that how many of these betulot are we looking at here? And the fact that he not only liked this one more than that, but liked her so much that she was doing this for her. Right? And my suggestion was, all the more so because he was an actual saris, it's just telling us volumes about Esther's character from the get-go. Okay, now the reason that I'm pointing this out, and I want everybody to keep this in mind, we're suggesting that it's possible that Esther originally, rather than the second version of Esther, right, the Esther B, where she's developing over the course of the story, I'm suggesting here that there's something about her character that is already from the get-go. Something special about her. Okay? And these are, I think, some of the indications. Okay, now, the pasuk yud. I think this can go either way. Lo yigida, this is what we discussed last week. Lo yigida Esther et amavi et meladata, ki mordechai tziva alei asher lo tagid. What happened? Esther never mentioned where she was from. Okay, so we discussed this last week. It doesn't tell us, text doesn't tell us why she didn't tell him. Okay, and the reason why, now we discussed this last week, that possibly it has something to do with, perceived anti-Semitism, perceived anti-Judaism sentiment that existed in the Persian monarchy. The problem is a couple of things. First of all, it doesn't seem to be, we are shown, given indication subsequently in the story that people know about Mordechai's Jewishness, and it doesn't seem that anybody cares. It only starts to matter when Haman reacts negatively. Possibly, we were suggesting, it's not clear, but it's possibly that he saw his lack of compliance with the king's decree as a function of his religion, which is what made him, which is what caused the ire about the religion in the first place. But until that point, we know of Avdei HaMelech B'Shar HaMelech that knew of Mordechai's religion, possibly the king already knowing of Mordechai's religion. And it doesn't seem to bother anyone. Not only that, but what we do know from the scholarly literature about the Persian monarchy, we think we pointed this out last week also, is that they were an extremely tolerant society. It was what defined them, what characterized them, as opposed to preceding empires. They believed that everybody should be left to their own devices to worship whatever deities they wanted to, as long as they pay their taxes. Okay, a type of religious freedom that at that point in the ancient world was kind of unprecedented. So we're looking at at something that is a little bit inconsistent. So that leaves us with the question of why Esther chose not to disclose her identity. Now it could be simply because Mordechai told her to, and then it just begs the question, why did Mordechai tell her to? But it also could be that Esther was in some way choosing to do this on her own. And it does say, ki Mordechai tziva alei asher lo tagid, Mordechai technically commanded her, but what we were suggesting last week was maybe if we translate tziva not as command, but as suggested, recommended, or right, like a cabinet secretary proposed, and she was the executive and was in the position to make that decision whether or not to do it, she chose to acquiesce to his proposal, not that she was complying with his command. But like I said, I think this can go either way. And then the same thing with Pasuk Yud Aleph, verse 11. V'chayom ayom Mordechai mitalech lifnei chatzar beit hanashim, v'adat et shalom Esther u'ma ya'aseh la. Mordechai went every single day. How do we read this? Do we read this as Mordechai trying to keep Esther on a good leash because he needs to control her? Or do we read it as Mordechai going there awaiting instructions, or going there trying to provide information, or going there trying to make proposals about what his next actions and activity should be? That's always the question, and I think it's open. All right, that's the murky color. I use this brownish color. Okay. Text goes on. Esther is given her turn in Pasuk Yud Bet. She's given her Vagia Torah Esther, right? This is in the small print. And then how did this go? She would come at night, and then in the morning, you would leave Achashverosh's room, and then you would go to Shashgaz, who was the second Saris HaMelech, and he would watch over that. You would transition from being a betula, from being a court virgin, to being a pilagesh, to being a concubine. Now, this was a servitude for life, these women that were collected. Right? Mordechai really had no prayer of ever getting his cousin, wife, whatever, his stepdaughter back. This is all about you know, being taken for life. So Esther's taken in, and now we read Pasuk Tedvav. Uvahagia Tor Esther. All right, and this is very, you have to, the more you read these psukim, the more you see how suspenseful these psukim are trying to be. Uvahagia Tor Esther, even the trup is very, Uvahagia Tor Esther, Bat Avichayil Dod Mordechai. It's giving you this very, you know what I'm talking about, right? Okay, it's giving you this very intense type of lead up to what's about to happen, and it's giving you, and letting you know something important is going on. Uvahagia Tor Esther, Bat Avichayil, first time, I put it in purple here because this is the first time that Esther, when Esther's originally introduced, she's not given any identity. She's just saying, like, he omen et Esther, et hadasa, he Esther bat dodo. She's introduced vis-a-vis Mordechai, her relationship to Mordechai. Now, we're told about Esther with her father. She's actually given, Esther's given a name, Esther bat Avichayil. And Avichayil now is now referred to as the uncle of Mordechai. Right, so as a transition from Perek Aleph, and again, we're far from Perek Aleph now, where Esther's, you know, supposedly coming of age and becoming a strong character.
Avichayil is a male or female?
Avichayil is a male. Avichayil is, all right, who is Mordechai? Mordechai was Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimi ben Kishi Shimini. So Mordechai had a father, Yair. Yair and had a brother named Avichayil. Avichayil had a daughter named Esther.
Avichayil appear anywhere in Tanakh?
Not this Avichayil. Does the name appear elsewhere in Tanakh? I am embarrassed to say that I don't remember, but it might be.
Avichayil usually is a...
That's Avichayil.
Avichayil also.
It rings a bell, and I'm confident that the answer is yes, but I'm not sure. The Mefarshim actually discuss who these Ya'ir, Shimi, and Kish are. The Gemara is very insistent on linking Mordechai to Shaul ben Kish. I mean, Shaul lived many years at the beginning of Bayit Sheni, Bayit Rishon period, and we're already in Galut Bavel. So obviously, this is long before. It's a good question, but and you know, it also calls Manishiminis from Shevet Binyamin. I'm not concerned with this right now. The point that I want to make is that already in Perek Bet, after Esther is taken, when she's still at the mercy of the king, she's referred to as Esther Bat Avichayil, and her relationship to Mordechai is spoken through her connection, through her ancestry, not Mordechai's ancestry. It's no longer Uvamot Aviyavima like Acham Mordechai Lelavat. It's now Esther Bat Avichayil, who is the Dod Mordechai. Okay. But it still mentions Mordechai. So Dod Mordechai Asher Lakach Lelavat, and then again, once again, the only thing that we're told about Mordechai, if you're counting now, this is the fourth time, this is the fourth thing, the only thing that we know about Mordechai is that he's the foster father, foster caretaker of Esther. Lavo al Amelech, it's time for her to come to the king. Lo biksha davar ki imet asher yomar higaisri samelech shomer anashim. Okay, how do you read this? Why is Esther not taking anything? She doesn't take anything except for what higaisri samelech tells her to take. What do you think? Why is Esther not taking anything?
She doesn't want to get chosen.
So maybe it could be that she doesn't want to get chosen. Okay, but it's a tough life for somebody who doesn't get chosen now, because now you're still stuck in the king's harem and you're just a pilegesh. You're essentially the king's wife anyway. You're just of a lower level. So some of the mafreshim talk about how she didn't want to get chosen. I think it's actually a tough read because I don't really see what the advantages of not being chosen. What else? Why do you think Esther? But it doesn't say that she didn't choose anything. It says that she completely submitted her will. She was mevatel her dat to Haggai. Why do you think so? What do you think? Why might Esther have chosen not to make any, you know, concrete personal decisions about how to dress and how to prepare for her night with Achashverosh?
She had advice from someone who knew what the king wanted.
All right, it could be that she's trying to get advice from the person who knew best. I mean, by the way, we're not told why Haggai likes her so much. This might be why. All right. Think about these endless women that are constantly coming in that he's put in charge of. And every single person's got 101 opinions about what is going to make her, what she looks best in. I look best in this angle with this color makeup. I look best in this color, this type of clothing. I look, you know, this is the type of music that should be played when we're there. This is the type of food I want prepared. 1,001 opinions about how they're going to get selected. Esther comes along and says, by the way, ingeniously, who is the one here who is going to know the best about what the king likes? This isn't about what I think the king will like, it's about what the king likes. Haggai is the one most familiar here. So she says, you tell me what to do. So I think that, first of all, I think that that actually is indicating that probably she wanted to get chosen. But what it also is giving us another indication of why Esther is so good at getting people to like her, is because she, first of all, knows how to manage a situation, but she also knows when to let people, you know, when to give people the control that they either want or think they deserve or do deserve, and allowing them in those given situations to, you know, to be the one to, you know, to guide the day. So that, so Esther does that. I think a secondary read, all right, so that puts Esther, I think, in the Machiavellian, right, the much more of the dominant character type of mold. I think a secondary way of reading it is that she is the patsy who was always waiting around for to be told what to do by her cousin Mordechai. And now she doesn't have Mordechai there in the harem, so the only guy that is there is Haggai, and she says, okay, I'll just do whatever he says, the same way that I always do it over whatever Mordechai says. I think both are reads, but I, of course, considering what we've been saying, I like the first read better. Okay, and then we are now given another character trait of Esther in the pink, Vatihi Esther noset chen b'enei kol ro'eha. And I think that it's not coincidental, considering the first read of this verse, I think it's not coincidental that we're told that Esther makes everybody likes Esther immediately after this indication that we're given about what Esther's doing. Right, that she's specifically, you know, she's being mevatel her dat. She's doing whatever it is that Haggai wants thinks that she should do. Okay, reading on. Hezayin. Vatilakach Esther el haMelech Achashverosh el Beit Malchuto b'Chodesh Asiri u'Chodesh Tevet b'Shna Shev el haMalchuto. Okay, I'm reading this right now just so that everybody gets a sense of where we are in the story. This is the seventh year. What was the when we opened up the Megillah? What year of the reign were we? The third year. So that means this is 4 years since Vashti's passing. Anybody who thinks, who reads the Megillah, and we do this because, like I said, we read the Megillah in 45 minutes an hour, you have to realize the pace of things. Vashti was deposed 4 years earlier, and now Esther's finally being taken in, and seemingly immediately thereafter is being crowned queen. So this is 4 years in between the beginning of the story and now. That's a lot of time for everybody to know. First of all, for Esther to know what's going on? Who is our king? We have the opportunity to read about him in the daily newspapers. All right, we have both the pro and con press. All right, and she also has the opportunity to research over this period of time what is it that allows somebody to get ahead in this kingdom. By the way, we don't hear about Mordechai until now. It could be that previously in Perek Aleph, Mordechai was not a member of the court, and in the intervening 4 years, becomes a member of the court. It also could be showing us just how long, maybe they started this process immediately after, and I mean, the king is going to spend one night per betulah. There were a lot of betulot in the kingdom. Seemingly, this was going to take him a long time. All right, so it could be that this process actually began shortly after Perek Aleph, but it actually took several years before we got to the point of Esther being selected. So this is a very important, very, very important process that we need to, you know, that we need to point out, just in terms of how the length of time that's passing here. Okay, and then so b'shnat shev l'malchuto v'yahav haMelech Esther immediately. All right, consistent with what we saw with Haggai and the end of that. Noseichem be'enei kol ro'eha, but yahav haMelech. By the way, notice it doesn't tell us what she took, how she set up the room, what she did. Previous, in the setup to the night with the king, the text is telling us how important, what things that everybody chose and how it went. I think that what's indicating here is that it had absolutely nothing to do with what Haggai actually chose. It had everything to do with Esther's natural appeal. She, not only was she beautiful, but she was noset chen b'enei kol ro'eha. Okay? Whatever color dress she was wearing or whatever music they played that night seemingly did not play much of a role. Okay, moving on. I think it's actually interesting the pace of the text right now after we've been giving the indication about just how long this has taken. The process of selecting a queen is something like 15 psukim between describing the process and then describing Esther's process. Now, the process of Esther actually being selected, not only are we told nothing about it, it happens within the span of one pasuk, within one verse. Esther is taken into the king for the night, and then she's chosen and crowned in the same thing. I mean, such quick pace when you compare it to what's happened until now. So, seemingly, Esther was, you know, I take it from that Esther had that level of appeal. People liked her that much that as soon as Achashverosh laid eyes on her, he didn't have any question at all, right? And the girl of his dreams, the wife of his dreams, the concubine of his dreams, whatever the case may be. Okay. Vayaz Hamelech Mishte Gadol L'Chosra Vayavadav Et Mishte Esther. The king crowns Esther and then makes some type of coronation party for Esther. And this, I think, is just a fascinating, fascinating piece of information that the Megillah gives us here. V'hanachal medinot asa v'yitin maseit kiyad hamelech. What does that mean? How does he translate it here? He declared a public holiday for the provinces and gave out gifts with royal generosity. It's actually not how the GPS translates it. GPS translates it that he gives like a type of dispensation to the people. V'yitin maseit kiyad hamelech. We can connect it to the people's, we can connect it to the people's, the Esther party. But it is not, I don't think that's necessarily clear. It's probably the simplest shot. But immediately, what I think that we're seeing in Achashverosh's character, and which is why this is really would have been for the fourth year that we didn't give, but Achashverosh is trying to curry favor constantly. Constantly. He's always making these parties. He's always worried about who his friends and his enemies are, of which he has many, as we're going to see already in the very next pasuk. All right? But where Achashverosh is so concerned, ad kedei kach, that he wants everybody to be ecstatic about Esther's selection. Think about this. Why might that be? What happened after Vashti's downfall? What was the word that went out to everyone?
That the man has to be...
That men, well, I mean, this is really just a ludicrous sounding decree, but that men needed to be dominant in each individual household. How do you think that, if you're a subject in one of these 127 provinces, getting these royal decrees by a man who apparently is willing to put you to the death if you defy him, how would you like getting a ridiculous decree like this? Alright? And you probably were thinking, oh God, what is this crazy king doing now? I hope his next queen doesn't have any weird quirks, because then next we're going to have an even weirder or even more intrusive or difficult to comply with or just draconian type of decree. I don't know. We'll leave that for now. If anybody has any thoughts, let me know. But we're gonna move on. Okay. So the next thing that we're immediately told, not only is he giving presents, but also another character trait of Achashverosh, uvikavetz betulot sheni. Mordechai Yoshev B'Shar HaMelech. So immediately after is selected. Again, this could be a passage of years. It could be a passage of minutes. We don't know. But the text is giving us this indication that immediately after Esther is selected, right then the king is looking for new women. So that's telling us, again, foreshadowing to the future, to the next piece. First of all, it's showing Esther about the limits of her influence. It's also telling us about Achashverosh and his possibly, seemingly whimsical fancies that he's not, even if he has the girl of his dreams, that he immediately loves and immediately crowns and makes a party for and gives the entire empire presents as a result. Even with that, he still needs to go find new women. So Esther is already met with the challenge or the reality of her limited influence, and this is very significant. Okay, the next thing we read last week, so I don't want to rehash it. But again, Ein Esther maget la'tavi atamak asher tzivah aleha Mordechai v'et ma'amar Mordechai Esther osak asher ha'tzivah aleha na'itel. So this is now two. Now that she's queen, we're given two, stating two things about Esther, which are essentially the same. We wouldn't really need the first if we had the second, but it repeats the fact that she never tells anybody her ancestry. Again, we don't really know why, and I think that this might be, I mean, it's important for our story, but it might be equally about telling us her relationship with Mordechai. Two ways to read it, as I keep saying. Either that she's taking orders, or that she's taking proposals and advice from her fact finder, maybe husband, cabinet secretary, but not necessarily that she is the dominant creator. You have something you want to say? It looks like you have something on the tip of your tongue.
Achashverosh apparently was so insecure and was always looking for ways to solidify his position that his being married to Esther served no political purpose. And as long as he was unaware of the insignificance of her background and that it was not to his advantage at all to be married to her, she thought she should keep it quiet, and that's why he kept looking. Because he was always looking
to forge
new political.
So Chazal actually have this take about Esther and her lineage and Achashverosh looking for. We've spoken about this quite a bit in the past. Here's what I hear. It's very interesting and definitely a plausible suggestion. But the reason why I think it's not so you know, so chalak. No, I'm going to tell you why. It's because we're not given lineage and identities of any of the women in Achashverosh's life. Vashti, we're not given. I mean, there are midrashim about who she was, but the text doesn't tell us anything. Just that she was beautiful. It seemed like this was a man that liked pretty wives, and even may have liked Esther's character, but doesn't seem to. And I'm not sure. I think I heard this once. This is not something I've ever read about, but it might be in conflict with what we know about the Persian monarchy. It, unlike other monarchy, again, I'm not. I have to confirm this. I'm pretty sure I heard somebody say this once. So this is ABPAID from many years ago. But if what I remember is correct, Persian monarchy was not about marrying for lineage the way other monarchies have been in the past or and present. So maybe, but I don't know. Okay, so the different ways of reading this statement. Okay, so now we get into Big Tan and Terah. So immediately after, and again, I pointed this out last week, I think it's extremely significant, we're not talking about Achashverosh right now, but the text, if you're trying to figure textually what's being emphasized here, the second after we're told that Achashverosh is not satisfied with his wife and needs to, you know, have more Pilag Shot, so immediately after that, we're being told about the, you know, insurrection. Plots to assassination plots. So this is somebody, even though he's been now king for 7 years, or maybe more, depending on what we don't know about the passage of time at this point, past the 7-year mark, after Esther was taken for that first night. But even somebody who's been king for this long is still has a limited hold on power and is nervous as a result. It's very important. So in terms of our character development of Esther, so we pointed out that Vayivada Hadavar LaMordechai is because it became known to him as a passive term, which means that possibly Mordechai didn't even necessarily do anything all that special to find out. It became known to him. And Vayagid LaEsther Malkah, Mordechai, who is not a person of great influence and savvy, doesn't go and tell the king, but rather he tells Esther. Maybe it's because he didn't have access, or maybe it's because he wasn't. All right, what I suggested last week, at least as a possibility, was that it's not because he's not as dominant and the calculating of a character as we assume him to be. So he tells Esther, and then Esther could have just told Achashverosh, but it's now Mordechai getting credit is entirely due to Esther's maneuvering. Vatomer Esther Lamelech b'shem Mordechai. It doesn't need to have said that. It just could have been Vatomer Esther Lamelech. The fact that Mordechai is the one that gets credit for this, even if we are reading correctly, that's at least possible that he didn't do much as a result, is all because of Esther's maneuvering. Very, very important. Now we have completely flipped the paradigm on its head. Now, no longer is Esther advancing and being successful because of advice that she's getting from Mordechai. Now Esther is being successful and getting and advancing, firstly because of her natural ability to be noseit chen bein kol ro'eha. Everybody likes her. Haggai likes her. Shashgaz likes her. Achashverosh likes her. Everybody likes her. Okay. Not only that, but in addition to that, she's actually bringing Mordechai up with her, if we're reading this correctly. Mordechai's advancement, which we are going to see in the rest of the story, is extremely significant, is in a large part due to Esther. Okay.
Wouldn't Achashverosh be who's this Mordechai guy that Esther has a connection with?
So we pointed this out. We actually pointed this out last week when we were doing Mordechai. Mordechai is clearly a court Jew. Right, he's clearly a member of the court and is involved with Esther. He's Yoshe B'Shar HaMelech constantly. The Avdei HaMelech B'Shar HaMelech know Mordechai, know that he's a Jew, and notice that every single day where Haman's decree, where the king's decree to bow to Haman or to do gesture to Haman is applicable, Mordechai is there. Right, he's in the inner circle. So I think that the simple answer to your question is that the indication from the text is that in Achashverosh's court, people conversed with the queen. So nobody raised an eyebrow about Mordechai talking to her because of his position in the court and Esther and who Esther was. I think that's the simple answer. Okay, Perek Gimel. Which is number 4 here, but Perek Gimel we're actually not going to look at. But I wanted to point out again, Perek Gimel is all about Haman's decree, right? Haman getting ticked off at Mordechai and appealing to Achashverosh to destroy the Jews as a result. Take a look in Pasuk Zayin. This is when Haman makes the goral, makes the pur. B'chodesh arishon hu chodesh nisan b'shnat 12 la'melech Achashverosh, in the 12th year of Achashverosh's reign. How many years have passed since Esther has become queen?
Five.
Yeah. Okay, so this is, again, something that we, in a 45-minute Megillah read, we think is happening, da, 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 but the text is going out of its way to tell us, and it doesn't need to, it going out of its way to tell us that 5 years have passed. Okay, so when Mordechai is going to come along in the next chapter and say, oh, umiyodeim la'it kazot igat malchut, and reread that, you know, how do you know, maybe this is the whole reason that you became queen. And we read that, knowing not only the end of the story, but having read that she became queen literally 5 minutes ago, right? We assume, of what else might you think? Try and put yourself in the shoes of the people, of the characters in the story, and understand that Esther was sitting around as the king's queen, only seeing him once a month, having seemingly not much of a relationship with him, for 5 whole years before the next part of the story develops. Yeah?
You started the talk about that Esther is the one that is dominant in this whole story. Mm-hmm. But here she says, well, how can I help? I'm not seeing the king.
In the chapter. So we're going to look at this inside, okay? That's what I want to discuss now. Okay, so, can you hold off for 1 minute?
Sure.
Okay, so now Perek Dalet, and I want to be done in 10, 12 minutes, so we're going to have to zip through this, and unfortunately, once again, we're not going to be able to finish everything. Probably would have been wiser to do Esther over 2 weeks. All right. Bezrat Hashem next year. Mordechai hears what's going to happen. And now I want in this chapter 4, I want to pay attention to what Mordechai does, and I want to contrast it with what Esther does, how Esther reacts. Okay, now part of it is information, the information flow, and what Esther knows when she's in the king's court versus what Mordechai knows by being in the streets, all right, and going to shul in the morning. But part of it is also how, trying to understand the characters that we're dealing with and how they are reacting to the information. Mordechai adat kol, this is in small print. I just want to read a couple of things very quickly. This is in source 3, numbered 3, in page 2. Mordechai adat kol asher na'asa v'yikra Mordechai et begadav v'yilbash sak v'yifer. Mordechai hears what happens, and what we suggested last week was seemingly in counterproductive maneuver, he runs out into the street and just starts crying and making a public display of mourning. Rather than using his power and influence, which we think that he has, and to go knock on doors, right, of members of Achashverosh's inner circle to try and do something about this, he just goes out and makes a public spectacle of the story. Now, understandable that he does so, but maybe we at least can make the suggestion that there were better things for him to be doing. Compare that to what we're going to read about Esther. Okay. So what happens? The Esther's servants come along and they tell her what Mordechai is doing. He's disheveled, he's full of dirt and ash, and he's lying and screaming in the street. And she's vatit chalchal is a very interesting phrase. First of all, it's reflexive, it's vatit chalchal, and it means, and it's translated a different way, but she's full of dread. Right? Let's say we translate, there's different ways to translate this. You know, if she's full of fear, full of, anxiety about what's happening with Mordechai, so it could be because she had absolutely no idea about what was going on with Haman. And obviously, if Mordechai is doing this, something really bad must happen. I submit to you, maybe there's a possibility that the reason that she's furious right now, is that Vatit Chalchal is more about she's full of anger or full of frustration because her fact-finding cabinet secretary advisor, who she relies on for information, is stuck wearing shmatas outside when she needs him inside, so she can make sure that she's guiding her her actions in the way that she needs to. She needs all the information she can get. She relied on Mordechai not as a father figure necessarily, but as an advisor, and without her advisor, she's lost. So she's angry at him, and I think that actually might be an explanation for what she does next. Batishlach, right? So they tell her what's going on. Batishlach begadim, this is in purple. Halbishet Mordechai ulahasir sakal mi'alav. She sends, the first thing that she does is not, oh my God, Mordechai, what's wrong? But get yourself in here immediately. Give me your clothes. Is she giving you clothes because she wants him to feel better? Or is she giving clothes because she said, I need you here right now. Get over here. She doesn't say come. She just sends him the clothes. All right, like I said, different ways to interpret it, but either way, this is Esther doing the action. Mordechai's actions usually are passive, often are counterproductive, is what we were pointing out last week. Esther's actions are very, very mission-driven and purposeful. Right? She's sending him clothes. It could be because she wanted him to look more dignified. I'm suggesting it's because she wanted him here immediately. Mordechai refuses. Maybe it's because he thinks that now what's necessary is mourning and public display of you know, devastation. Maybe it's because he, or what we suggested last week, he wanted to keep distance, because now at this critical juncture, after Jews are basically slated for death, she doesn't want anybody to draw the connection between Esther and Mordechai anymore, because maybe they'll start asking questions about Esther. Maybe. I don't know. Okay, but so now they have this messenger back and forth. We're going to skip around here. We'll look at Pasuk Zayin. Vayagid lo Mordechai et kol asher karov et parashat akesav asher amar haman lishkol agedzei amelech bayudim labdam. I am so interested as to why, of all the details that are repeated here about what Mordechai tells her, it's the money that Haman had offered, which, by the way, the king had refused, the money that Haman had offered to pay to the king's treasury in order to get this job of killing the Jewish people done. Of all the details to describe about this decree, why is it that this is what Mordechai feels the need to tell Esther? I'll leave it to you. We don't really have time to discuss it right now, but I think it might have something to do with Achashverosh. It's another hint as to what Achashverosh's character is. What makes him move? What makes him tick? Anything that's in the best interest of the monarchy.
Of
what?
It's a tremendous amount of money.
It's a huge amount of money, but it's still. If I say, right, there's $1 million in the bank, and given to an assassin who's here to kill us, the fact that the assassin is here to kill us is the important thing, not the fact that there's money in the bank. Who cares? We're talking about a mass genocide of the Jewish people. That Achashverosh has money in the bank shouldn't really matter unless it is directly connected to what's going on in the story. All right, but we do not have time, so we're going to move on. Okay, take a look at Pasuk Chet. The next Pasuk, Patshegen Ksavadat. And he basically sends her a copy of the royal decree. That he's there to command her again. That she should go before the king and request for the life of her people. Okay, so now, Lutzavot, we read it the classical way as being a command, or is what Mordechai is doing now falling into his usual role, just doing it via messenger, of giving a proposal from a secretary or an advisor?
Does Mordechai ever talk to Esther directly, or it's always them through messengers?
The only talking between Esther and Mordechai in the entire story is here. The only actual quotation marks. It's not face to face. Other than that, we know that Mordechai is around and keeping tabs on Esther. But Mordechai, as we pointed out last week, does very little talking in the Megillah. Very little talking. And here it's through a messenger. So, and as we pointed out in the first one, that he never even says a word to Haman. They never speak to each other. So it's fascinating that for the what we think originally was what we always thought was the dominant character, which to a certain extent the text proposes as the dominant character with Perek Yud, and the way it closes, is got a character here that really doesn't do much talking, and even when this is Mordechai's most dominant moment of the Megillah, and it's all through a messenger. So, okay. That's what's going on. All right, let's flip over and read the end of this chapter. Because this is where I think, you know, the different readings of Esther, this is the most critical spot. Vayomer, after they exchange discussions about how to deal with the situation, about what's going to happen in the situation, Esther says, I'm never going to be able to do it, because everybody knows that the king is going to kill anyone that comes to him uninvited. Vayomer Mordechai l'ashiv el Esther, al tadam even avsheich limaleit bit ha-melech mikol ha-yudim. Don't think for one second that you are going to be spared by the royal decree. Now, first of all, how does Mordechai know this? Number one, how does Mordechai know that Esther herself is going to be included in the decree? Don't you think it's possible that the king is going to look at this decree and say, you know, Haman, I don't mind you killing all the Jewish people, but do you mind sparing my queen? Where is he so confident from that Esther is going to be included? Number one, I think more importantly though, Esther in the previous puzzle, we didn't read it inside, comes and says, I can't go do what you want of me because the king has these rules about approaching him. And if I violate them, I'm going to get killed. We suggested last time, possibly the reason for that is because you got one bullet in your gun, you got to save it for the best possible time. She needs to be able to exert her influence in the place where she thinks it's going to do some good. But in this case, Mordechai is telling her to essentially commit suicide. I'm going to shoot my bullet into the air and then have the king kill me, essentially. Mordechai impugns her motives right now and says, no, she's not being strategic. She's acting in self-interest. I don't want to do this because I'm going to get killed. And considering what we will know about Esther in the very next pasuk, it's actually a really, really misguided read on Esther's intentions. She has no problem dying. She's totally willing to die. She just wants to be able to do it in a way that at least there's a chance of there having some effect. Tetvav, Esther sends back to Mordechai, Leich knoset kol ha-yudim ha-nimtzaim b'shushan, v'tzumu alai v'yal tochlu v'yal tishtu shaloshet yamim laila v'yom, gam ani v'narotai atzum kein. Mordechai stops talking for the rest of the Megillah. Right? We don't hear from him again. I mean, we hear from him, but he's a character. He's a prop. He's a straw man, essentially, in the rest of the story. And even though he's the one that's holeich v'gadol at the rest of the story, Esther is managing the details the rest of the way.
Sorry, go back to what you said. So why did Mordechai think that she would not be saved if she was the queen?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I'm wondering why he thought that, right? But either way, the fact that he immediately impugns her motives, all right? Esther's showing us that that's not the case. So maybe we're dealing with, or if you remember to the versions that we opened up with, if it's version B that Esther is coming of age here in this story. All right, which I guess is plausible because it's been 5 years since, at least 5 years since the previous, since she was became queen. If you're going to say that, then this is Esther's moment where she says, "No, I'm going to call the shots." If it's like I've been suggesting that Esther, from already the get go, treats Mordechai more as a cabinet secretary at best, as an advisor, as a fact producer, right, and advice giver possibly, but she's the one who makes the executive decisions. If that's the case, then here we're looking at her basically giving him, saying, all right, I don't need you anymore. Do what I say. You are now going to serve me. Okay, so here's where I think there's a really great question. We don't have time to deal with this because we're pretty much out of time. But we understand the religious... Hey guys, we understand the religious value of having a fast. Okay, let's ask the question: What other reason might there be for telling everybody to gather together and fast for me? All right, think about what Haman's complaint about the Jewish people were. Yeshno am mifuzar mifurad v'chol medinot ma'achutecha, v'dateihem shonot mikolam. They're scattered all over the place. If you suddenly have an entire population, an entire section of the population that stops eating, maybe the food suppliers are going to suddenly notice. Maybe people are going to suddenly notice everybody walking around, you know, bony and scaly, and in mourning. But the fact that you actually have a unified people here, I don't think that this is the clearest read, but it's a suggestion that I thought of. Recently, maybe one of the reasons why is because Esther wants there to be some show of unity among the people, so that everybody involved is going to see the Jews and see that they're not mefuzar mefurad the way Achashverosh thinks. Why that might be, right, we'll have to discuss another time. Okay, we're out of time, so I don't want to do too much of this. Let's see. There's one or two more points that I want to make. Oh, okay. So this is actually very interesting. This is just a few. I'll just make a couple of points that I think I've never heard anybody say and really came to me. If you look in the next chapter in Perek Hay, right? So we're in the middle of page 3 in Perek Hay. Esther comes along and goes through with her plan. This is a very critical moment in the Megillah. So we think of her as storming in. All right. I'm going to do what I can and say I need to, I'm putting my life on the line. It's not true. It's not what actually happens. Even in this moment, she's extremely gentle and strategic and using her noset chen b'enei kol ro'eha. What does she do? She doesn't storm in. She stands there. V'tilbash ester malchut. First of all, she wears her finest. Is Mordechai ever mention anything about that? It's making a specific point of highlighting the things that appeal to Achashverosh. Achashverosh thinks she's beautiful and thinks that she's appealing, so she plays the part. Batibash Esther Malchut, dignified and queenly. Batamod b'chatzar beit hamelach apnimit, nochach beit hamelach. She stands in the king's inner chamber, but does she storm in and run to the throne? What would you say? How would you describe in translation? How would you describe the scene? Where is she standing? If there's a room that she's not allowed to go into, where in the room is she standing?
At the doorway.
At the doorway. She inches in and stands there and waits for Achashverosh to notice her, which is exactly what happens. Achashverosh notices that she's standing there, repeating that phrase. Again, We have this three or four times with Esther that people just like her. She's likable. Her strength in the story is that people like her without her doing things. Let Haggai take care of everything. Let Ahasuerus just like me, right? Being a noset chen, being no koroeha, and then once people like her and bring her in, that's when she exerts her influence. That's how Esther operates, and it's not just brilliant. It's the way to best use your skills and your natural appeal, you know, to achieve your goals. And then what does she do here? And this is, I think, a point I didn't realize this actually until last night when I was preparing. Vatiga b'rosh ha-sharvit. Right? When Esther's describing the entire process in the previous paragraph, you couldn't read it inside. But, you know, kol avdei melech asher b'rosh ha-melech yodim asher kol ish ve'isha. Alright? If you don't have an appointment with the king, you're going to get killed if you go into his room. Melvad me'asher yoshit lo ha-melech ha-sharvit ha-zahav v'chaya. The only way that you're going to get spared is if he waves his scepter. Should he say anything about touching the scepter? What do you think this is indicating? That Esther's touching the scepter. Vatiga b'rosh ha-sharvit. What do you think?
More confident.
Maybe it's confidence. Anybody else? I think it's something. This is not coincidental. I don't know. What do you think?
More like a connection. She's like, you know, I'm your queen. It's not her it's like scepter, but it's like I'm
a moment of intimacy, right? I think it's like I don't know if that's what you're saying, but that's like this. And this is the slightest textual nuance. But I think it's giving us another indication of just how in control she was, knowing Ahasuerus's appeal, you know, what her own appeal, knowing what Ahasuerus's weaknesses were, and Vatiga b'rosh ha-sharvit. It had nothing to do with the rules. It was nowhere in the rule book. It had anything to do with touching the rosh ha-sharvit. Ahasuerus waves and says, "Come," and she touches it.
Seductive.
Yeah, whether it's seductive, or whether it's Machiavellian, she's trying to control the situation, but she understands how she's doing something here to give an added touch that has nothing to do with the decree. And Ahasuerus falls for it. He's into it. All right? And he says immediately, what do you want? And this is repeated over and over again. Now this is something that we would need to understand within the context of understanding Ahasuerus's character. Why is he constantly trying to offer half the kingdom to the queen? And the reason is, possibly, because this situation is only going to be the case. Esther's only going to be risking her life, him knowing she's risking her life to come here, if there was something going on. And he suspects that there is new plot. I only see my queen once a month. How likely could it be that if I had enemies, that they would try and court the queen and, you know, usurp my throne as a result, you know, through marrying the queen and defeating me? We already know. I mean, it's not coincidental. We need to know the Big Tan Tara story because of what it tells us about Mordechai and the future of the rest of the story. But it also tells us a lot about the nature of the court and how Ahasuerus is trying to consolidate power throughout the entire story. And this gives us a reason to show that he has anxiety. Esther knows how to capitalize on that anxiety, which is why. Think about what Mordechai told her to do, and this is essential in understanding Esther's character. Maybe we should have really started with these prakim, but I think this is a part of the story that we know better than the others. This is a story where Esther is taking Mordechai. Mordechai just said, "Go in front of the king." Esther needs to go in front of the king and ask for the nation's life. She doesn't do that. She recognizes the king's weakness, trying to get him to a point where he's both at the height of his anxiety, worried about his own future, but also worried about what Esther's, you know, but also wanting to do for Esther because of her appeal. Vatiga b'rosh ha-sharvit. He wants to, appeal. She wants to do for this person that he has this intimate connection with. So he goes through this process. She goes through this process, pushing all of these buttons. And in the same time, again, we don't have time to do it, she's also looking to capitalize on what we read about with Haman in the first week. She's trying to capitalize on the vaulting ambition and spelling Haman's downfall in the process. Let me close with one final point. I'm sorry that we didn't have time to do everything. I pointed out, I don't know if it was ever in this Sunday morning context, but in Drashot and Shirim, I pointed out the way I read every single year, the Shirat Hayam, that the entire process of the Yitziat Mitzrayim was not just the question of the physical salvation of the people, but it was also about the psychology of the people, the development of the people's character and persona. And ad kedei kach, that Shirat Hayam was significant, not because of the physical salvation, not only because of the physical salvation, but because of the fact that through the physical barrier now between them and Egypt, through the defeat, the downfall of their former taskmasters, and through this also, possibly this grand miracle, only at this point, Vayaminu ba'Hashem uv Moshe Avdo. It's only at this point that we're able to make this the psychology of the people is now ready for emunah in the Almighty God. I'm suggesting here that the same way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right, Lahavdil, because as important as Esther is, she's still not God, as the same way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is able with so many strokes, with only one stroke of a pen, to be able to accomplish so many goals, Esther is setting up all of the details here and allowing this drawn out process for the same type of idea. In the same moment, she is both ensuring the salvation of her people, ensuring her the continuity of her own influence in the court, punishing the guy involved with her, and also elevating her cousin, former foster father, who now in a position of great influence will have the ability to ensure the safety of the Jewish people in the Persian monarchy in perpetuity. Okay, I hope everybody. Thank you, everybody, for coming. I hope everybody enjoyed it, and this at least opened our eyes a little bit more to these different characters in the Megillah. Bezrat Hashem, we will give us something to think about. Bezrat Hashem, we'll report. Thanks so much, everybody. Have a good day.